The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, it's Mati here, and I'm just jumping in at the start of this episode to say that we had a few recording issues during this episode where some of Colby's audio got cut off. I did do my best to salvage most of it, but there were a couple parts of the conversation I had to cut, so you may notice a few odd cuts here or there. And unfortunately, I did have to scrap most of what Colby had to say about Coco. I'll be back to close out the episode because that also got a little bit butchered, but until then, thanks for listening, and I really hope you guys enjoy. Hello, and welcome to episode 38 of the Movie Marathoners podcast. I'm your host, Mati, and today I am joined by a familiar face. He is the co-host of the Minorities Report podcast and the host of the Colby Told Me podcast. Colby Mack, welcome back to the podcast. How are you doing tonight?
Yo, what up? It's your boy, Colby Mack, and I'm finally back on the Movie Marathoners podcast. Mati, how are you, my brother?
I am great. It has been a wonderful day, other than the fact that I got an email from my boss saying that because of this whole crisis of Corona thing that I will be working from home for most of the next couple weeks. Yeah, that is crazy news to me, but it means I'm probably going to be doing a lot of writing in front of TV and rewatching some TV shows or something just to keep me sane.
I mean, that's got to be a little good.
Yeah, it's a silver lining. I'm hoping that I'll still stay productive. Sometimes it's really difficult to be productive at home when you're working from home, but we'll see how that goes.
Oh, believe me, bro. I'm the exact same way. In my day job, when I'm not critiquing film, I work for a software company. And they're taking the same kind of, extent. They're deep cleaning this weekend and hoping that the person whose family believe may have it doesn't have it, so they don't have to then force us to stay home. So
shit, you've got a case.
Yeah.
Like,
so there's two reported cases in Atlanta, of course, in my county. yeah,
that sounds awful. I mean, I just work at a university, and it's an international university, so I think they're super super careful with all the precautions and everything. So we haven't had, classes suspended or anything, but all travel for academic purposes and all the trips that go to, study abroad and stuff, those have all been canceled. So it's trying times. I just went to Costco today, man. And for whatever reason, the whole Costco was stocked except toilet paper. There was no toilet paper. I don't know what it is.
I don't understand it. I don't know what, just the weirdest things are gone. Like,
yeah, I don't know. Maybe they're just like, oh, it's a virus, so maybe it's gonna cause some problems on the other end. I don't know, man. But anyways, this has been Corona 2020 Watch with Colby and Mati. Thank you so much for joining me today. We are not just going to be talking about the coronavirus today, probably a little bit of, here and there. You can't not talk about it. Last time you were on the pod was in December when we ranked the top five superhero films of the last decade.
Yeah.
That was a great episode, and I would highly recommend checking that out if you haven't yet. I thought we touched on basically every great superhero film between me and Colby's list, so it was a really good conversation. This week we'll be doing something similar. Colby and I will be doing a Pixar marathon. We'll be running through all of Pixar's feature films in chronological order, starting, of course, with Toy Story and ending with their latest film, Onward, which is in theaters now. We'll rank each of the 22 films from 1 to 22, with 1 obviously being Pixar's best and 22 probably being Cars 2. I don't have Colby's list, but I wouldn't be surprised. And then we'll finish with just a longer discussion on Onward and whether you should brave the coronavirus and go and see that out in theaters or not. But before we hop in, I will just throw out a light spoiler warning here. I don't want us to have to dance around certain parts of these films, and these are all older films. So if you haven't seen a certain film and you want a 100% guarantee that you won't be spoiled about it whatsoever, skip that section. We will, however, just not be spoiling Onward, as that is, that was just released in theaters last week. So if you do want a spoiler-filled discussion on Onward, I did guest on the Mike, Mike, and Oscar podcast to talk about Onward in depth. So definitely give that a listen and follow their show if for some reason you're listening to this podcast and you're not listening to that one. All relevant links will be in the show notes as always. All right, so let's just jump straight into this, Colby, with perhaps Pixar's most influential film. This is their first film in 1995, Toy Story.
You are a toy! You weren't the real Buzz Lightyear, you're an action figure! You are a child's plaything!
You are a sad, strange little man, and you have my pity. Farewell.
What are your thoughts on Toy Story, just in general?
Man, it's something that at the time when it came out, when I was a kid, I've never seen anything like it. And this is from a guy who's played with action figures up until my college years. I just love how my brain, you know, does with imagination. And when it comes to toys, I've always thought, and it's really weird, that when I don't play with them, they take it personally. And then here comes a story where literally these toys have feelings. And then that's a part of the Pixar formula going forward, is that this has feelings and this has feelings. And it laid the groundwork for one of the most successful studios in cinematic history. And a lot of people have attempted to copy it, some to success, some to not. And the thing is with Toy Story, like out the gate, it set the bar so high. But man, do I love it. And I mean, the amount of work that goes into one, making animated film. But at the time, the animation was like something we'd never seen. And the level of voice talent they got to work on a kids movie was just like out of this world. Tim Allen, Tom Hanks, John Ratzenberger, like it's at some like high quality stuff that you typically would not expect for a little kids film.
This is certainly a film that until I got a little more film savvy when I was younger, I definitely associated Tom Hanks with only Toy Story. He was Woody to me. And then when I saw him in live action stuff, I was like, that's the voice of Woody, that Tom Hanks guy. But I would say that I don't think I hold this film quite as high as some people just because it didn't come, you know, I came to it a little later after, you know, Toy Story and some of these other Pixar films had come out. So I never got to experience that kind of revolution that was the animation that came from this film. With that being said, Colby, where is this on your list from 1 to 22?
Yeah, so Toy Story, the original one, like after like really thinking about it, it's... I actually have it as number 6. It's quite high.
Okay.
And it was interesting, kind of like when you're going back and then, man, I haven't watched the film in a long time, but I'm kind of remembering everything because when I watched the film, I wasn't looking at it from a critical lens. Mm-hmm. So I had to kind of approach it a little bit differently. But then after really going through it and thinking about those moments and kind of piecing apart some parts that I may have forgot about, this feels really, really good inside my top 10 at number 6.
I mean, I guess we're not that far apart then because Toy Story is number 9 for me. And
okay.
I mean, everything you said, I agree with. I think it's a fantastic story, and it's got that Pixar world building that just, you have such a concept that maybe seems simple from the get-go, but then they really just dig into it and they kind of pull out, you know, they stretch it to its logical conclusions. And some of the things that they create in this film are it's really incredible, and it's really a fun film to watch. And I think that's a thing that I will probably be coming back to again and again with all these films, is that they are incredibly fun. And I think the reason that it may be low, quote unquote, at number 9 for me is that there's not a profound message in this film in the way that some of the other Pixar films that are a little more trying to tackle a specific thematic aspect are. Toy Story is more just a very, very good story and a very, very good concept realized.
Yeah. And I think because it was starting out the gate, I think Pixar went through like several evolutions in regard to their storytelling when they realized like how effective that they could be with giving a good kids movie, selling toys, but then offering up something a little bit more for adults. And Toy Story was a testing ground. And obviously to so much success, it's now the one that has the most amount of sequels to it.
For now.
Yeah. For now, correct.
Yeah. All right. So then after Toy Story in 1995, we get 3 years go by before we get another one. We get the fairly unforgotten, what I would call a Pixar gem, called A Bug's Life in 1998.
Now, let me tell you how things are supposed to work. The sun grows the food. The ants pick the food. The grasshoppers eat the food.
And the birds eat the grasshoppers. Hey, like the one that nearly ate you? You remember? You remember? Oh, you should have seen it. Okay? This blue jay, he has him halfway down his throat, okay? And Hopper's kicking and screaming, okay? And I'm scared. Okay, I'm not going anywhere near, okay? Oh, come on. It's a great story. Ow, 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 ow.
What are your thoughts on A Bug's Life?
It's not ants.
Is that good or
it
bad?
It was so weird. Like, I mean, I guess it's bad, but when it comes to a lot of these Pixar films, personally, I don't, well, there's not very many bad Pixar movies.
Right.
And I don't consider A Bug's Life to be a bad film. Just, there was that time in the 90s where you had films that kind of came out pretty much right on the heels or right after, you know, right before another film that was so much like it, like, you know, Volcano and Dante's Peak and, you know, Armageddon and Deep Impact. And then you had Ants, which was, you know, with Sylvester Stallone, Jennifer Lopez, and then you had A Bug's Life. And Ants appealed way more to me. Don't know why, right? Maybe it's just a little bit more mature. But then when I saw Bug's Life, I was like, oh, wow, this is really cool. It's really fun. But I just got my bug movie. So it didn't stick with me as much as like it possibly should have at that time when it came out. So right now I actually have A Bug's Life closer to the bottom at number 20.
Bug's Life for me is actually, I mean, I was 3 when this movie came out. So,
oh my gosh, I was 12.
I didn't want to say I wasn't born when Toy Story came out. So I'll start a, yeah, but A Bug's Life was very much the one that over Ants appealed to me. So I do have a soft spot for A Bug's Life. I, again, though, haven't seen it since, I mean, I owned it on VHS back in the day.
Yeah.
And I probably haven't watched this film in over 10 to 15 years. So that being said, the things that I remember about it is that it is, again, just very charming, very entertaining. The entire world that they come up with is very well realized. And then it's got that edge that a lot of Pixar films have that even if they're for children, they still have kind of terrifying moments. Like Hopper is a very scary villain, and there are some kind of almost who's the guy, Tim Burton-esque feels to A Bug's Life. So a little higher for me, I have it at number 15.
Okay, not bad.
So then in 1999, we get the first of the many, many, many Pixar sequels. We get Toy Story 2.
I'm tour guide Barbie. Please keep your hands, arms, and accessories inside the car and no flash photography. Thank you.
I'm a marriage butt. I'm a marriage butt. I'm a marriage
butt. Single fellas.
Is it as good as Toy Story for you, Colby?
No, but what's weird is that I thought out of the four, Toy Story 2 is the weakest. And I don't know what it was where Toy Story 2 just didn't vibe with me when I was younger, but like I feel like now, like retrospectively, a lot of people kind of adore Toy Stories 2. So for me, I have it towards the middle of the pack. I have it at 15. I mean, it introduced another character. It found a way to do the things that when it gets to sequels, it's like, okay, well, let's just like redo this and package it differently. Mm-hmm. It had something new to say. It just, I don't know, it, for some reason, didn't speak to me as much because I think when it focused a little bit more on, I believe that's the one where it focused a lot more on Sid as like a big antagonist. Is that right?
Sid?
The kid who takes the toys apart and stuff, right?
No, that's Toy Story 1.
That is Toy Story 1? Well, yeah. See, that says something when I don't remember exactly the plot of Toy Story 2. Just didn't stick with me. However, there was something about it where when I kind of looked at a lot of the other films, I'm going to give it up there. So right in the middle of the – well, I guess not in the middle. It's 22 films total. at number 15.
Yeah, I'm right there with you at number 14.
Okay.
This is another film that I haven't seen for quite a while. I do think that – I think the characters in Toy Story 2 are kind of outshine the legacy of Toy Story 2 itself.
Okay.
So you have – characters like Bullseye and Jesse. Mm-hmm. Jesse? Yeah, Jesse played by Joanne Cusack. Those characters feel like very classic Toy Story characters. So even when you go into Toy Story 3, it's not like you've only had a film or even half a film with those characters. They feel just as integral to the Toy Story gang as Buzz and Woody. So I think that, you know, says a lot about Toy Story 2. But as for the actual film, it doesn't hold a special place in my heart whatsoever. So right in the middle of the pack. And again, middle of the pack for Pixar. We can talk about this a little bit. The quality of their library is incredible.
Absolutely.
You know, like the 15th movie in Toy Story 2 is better than the first, you know, two or three movies of most animated film, you know, studios. So. Yeah. So then their fourth feature is the start of what I would call the golden age of Pixar. This is where they kind of just started firing out masterpiece after masterpiece after masterpiece.
They definitely went on a run.
Yeah. The first, well, I'm going to call it it's a long golden age, I would say, but we can actually talk about that. The first one of these, though, is in 2001. This is Monsters, Inc.
Sully, you're not supposed to name it.
Once you name it, you start getting attached to it. Now put that thing back where it came from, or so help me!
What are your thoughts on Monsters, Inc.?
Yeah, this kind of like changed some things. I lean heavily into sci-fi, fantasy, and the fact that I have this world of monsters. And one of my favorite kids' films growing up was with Howie Mandel. And it was Real Monsters. Do you remember that? Have you ever heard of that movie?
I don't think I have. I'm sorry.
Oh, my gosh. So it's with Howie Mandel. He's in Monster, and he pretty much... Oh, my God. What's the kid from the Wonder Years? Damn it. he was in Deadpool 2. Oh, my gosh. Well, essentially...
Ben Savage?
Yes, Ben Savage. So Ben Savage and Howie Mandel, it's this... So pretty much, it's like the story of... Monsters, Inc., except how, you know, he doesn't believe in monsters underneath his bed until he finds a monster underneath his bed and he goes down into this elaborate world. It's a super dark kids film. It's like, it is wild. So when I was able to get that, like, in now this animated form and kind of go through it, like, the best part of these Pixar films for mostly all of them is the world building and kind of looking at this, kind of realize and actualize things. And it kind of pokes fun a little bit at some of, like, I don't want to say the horror genre, but just like, you know, scary, you know, movies and motifs that we kind of seen in film. And it was incredibly smart. It was really, really funny. I mean, you got some great voices that lended to it. You could see the animation stepped up even more, like the actual detail, you know, to Sully's hair. I remember that being such a big focal point to how blown away the folks were. So that definitely cracks the top 10 at number 10 for me with Monsters, Inc.
Yeah, so this is definitely the first film where Pixar starts just absolutely flexing with their animation capabilities. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you heard reports of how like each individual hair on Sully was individually animated, which I don't even really know what that means, to be honest, but it sounds impressive.
It really does.
But then again, going back to the Toy Story thing, they have this concept of this entire world and they completely build a realized and logical system around just this idea. And it's very clear that it started with a very simple idea. They said, okay, well, what if monsters exist and, you know, these monsters harness our screams as energy? Yeah. What would that mean? And the way that the company or Pixar, whatever you want to call it, is taking these ideas and then kind of fleshing them out into these movies that are not only creatively incredible, but also start to now have a lot of really mature and sophisticated themes. Things like talking about whether fear or comedy is more important, and this relationship between Boo and Sully. And it was one of the first movies that I saw as a kid where I was like, I need to see a sequel to this so I know what happens to Boo and Sully. Yeah. I need to see that interaction with them. How long has time, like how much time has passed mm-hmm. since when they see each other next? And obviously I think it's better if we don't see that. Please don't give us a Monsters Inc. too. But this film is really high for me. This is number 6 for me.
Nice.
So then we get to 2003's Finding Nemo, which is probably Pixar's first mega hit.
Hey, Mr. Grumpy Gills. When life gets you down, you know what you gotta do?
I don't wanna know what you gotta do.
Just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, swimming, swimming. What do? We swim, swim.
Dory, no singing.
Dory. I love to swim in.
Dory.
When you want to swim, you want
see,
to
I'm gonna get stuck now with that song. Now it's in my head.
Sorry.
This is a film that was so popular that it caused the demand for clownfish at pet stores to triple, which led to the mass harvesting of clownfish, which just devastated certain populations of clownfish around the world.
Wow.
And then it also simultaneously caused many fish owners to say, hey, we don't want to keep our fish because Nemo doesn't want to be kept. So they released their fish back into the ocean, but they failed to put them in the proper habitats. So the releasing of these fish introduced invasive species to reefs all around the world, which just started to cause devastating damage to the indigenous species.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know this.
It is quite bizarre. I find it hilarious that so many people saw a movie where somebody stole a clownfish from the reef and the dad went to all these lengths to get his son back that they would buy more clownfish. But, I could see myself as a child also wanting that. So with that in mind, Colby, what do you think about Finding Nemo?
I think Finding Nemo is a really tender son and dad story. And I really wish it didn't came out when I was in high school because I paid it no mind. This was the type of movie that was the furthest from my radar around my sophomore year in high school. So,
right.
But I did watch it, but it just didn't. It didn't hit me the way that I wish I could have watched it when I was a little bit more mature to kind of really understand and appreciate the themes that it was tackling. But having watched it since and. I haven't watched it yet with my daughter. We watched Finding Dory recently. But when I do remember it and kind of comparing between this and Finding Dory, I find this to be the superior film. I have it at number 14 for me. And I'm pretty sure I'm probably in the minority, with that ranking. But like I said, I mean, Pixar is like eating at itself of greatness. And while of recently, there's been more, I guess, I don't want to say more misses, but just not as big of hits like the Finding Nemos and the Toy Stores and stuff like that. It's where I got it. So 14.
14, wow.
14.
So Finding Nemo is not only my number one Pixar film, it is one of my favorite films of all time.
Oh, wow.
I absolutely love this film, and I will completely acknowledge that there is a huge, huge factor of nostalgia there. I don't even know if I could logistically have an argument with somebody who was trying to convince me that this movie was bad, because I don't think I would be able to listen to those arguments. And I'm certainly not saying that you're saying that this movie is bad, but I love this movie. I think it's so funny. I think the characters are so just relatable and brilliantly written, and the voice acting behind everybody is pitch perfect. And I watch this film over and over and over again, and it makes me laugh every single time. And then it again has those sophisticated messages behind what do you do as a parent who, for very real reason, is protective of their son, especially a son with a disability, which is, I mean, in Finding Nemo is obviously very literal, but you could have any type of thing in your child or a person that you care about that would make them susceptible to danger in the world. And how do you balance the idea that you want something for them, but you also want to protect them? I think it's, I'm not a father, but I just think it's an incredibly wonderful film, and I love it. And you're wrong. No, I'm just kidding.
Hey, to add a little bit of context, folks, in regards to number 14, I rate Finding Nemo an 8 out of 10. So that more so points to how great the catalog is for Pixar films.
Yeah. So I'm just giving you shit.
Absolutely. But if my number 14 is an 8 out of 10, that kind of lets you know where we're at. But no, that's dope. I'm going to force myself and my daughter to give it a rewatch, because I really want to – I feel that. Because like honestly, there's a lot of stuff that you just said that like, man, oh, that's right. That is tucked away in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just so fucking funny, man. The freaking seagulls that say mine, and the manta ray, and I could do a whole hour podcast.
The sea turtle. I feel like I've seen the show at the Disney World Park more than I've seen the movie.
That's fair. So yeah, I know that, I think Pixar, by nature of the fact that they are kids' films, and depending on how old you are when certain ones come out, there's going to be certain levels of nostalgia that you're not going to be able to separate when you're talking about these movies. But Finding Nemo is my number one. So then that was 2003. The following year, we got in 2004, we get Pixar's Fantastic Four. No, wait, we get The Incredibles.
You mean you killed off real heroes so that you could... pretend to be one?
Oh, I'm real. Real enough to defeat you! And I did it without your precious gifts, your oh-so-special powers. I'll give them heroics. I'll give them the most spectacular heroics anyone's ever seen! And when I'm old and I've had my fun, I'll sell my inventions so that everyone can be superheroes. Everyone can be super! And when everyone's super... no one will be.
What are your thoughts on The Incredibles?
Well, I guess we move from your number one to my number one.
All right.
Hands down, The Incredibles. And maybe it's because I'm a boy, or maybe it's just damn good. Like, I don't know what there isn't not to love about this superhero family that is dealing with a world that has shifted away of needing them. And I think that's such an amazing exploration. To be able to get this inside of a kid's film is just absolutely amazing. And this was one that, even though I was in high school, it just appealed to everything that I love. I grew up on superhero cartoon characters and comic books and the Power Rangers, and being able to essentially have this mock-up of the Fantastic Four, and then holding the movie in such high regard that I'm able to, as I got older, explore the film in different perspectives and how the family dynamic has changed. Like, the mother needs to stretch herself, so that kind of lends to this. And then, you know, it's just really, really amazing and smart and hella clever. And it's really funny. Each progressive film just steps up the animation that much more. And this is probably some of the most action that I've seen inside of a kid's cartoon film. Like, you typically don't get that. So this film really appealed to all of my sensibilities super hard. It was a lot of fun. Samuel L. Jackson, I mean, I love him as Frozone. And the thing is, I think out of all of the Pixar movies, this has the best villain. And I love a good villain, because I think your superhero can only be as good as your villain. And Syndrome, I mean, it made complete sense. And it was so, like, I mean, just... it was so stylized, like this cool kind of 50s aesthetic, you know, to the way how they built out this world. And man, it was number one, hands down. Love it.
Awesome. The Incredibles for me is number four. So completely agree with everything you just said. I think the things that I'll just touch on a couple things that you didn't mention, because I completely agree with everything you said. Can't say it better. One of the things that really surprised me about this is the relationship between Helen and Bob Parr is so... realistic. Their arguments that like an argument that you would have if you were an actual married couple and you were not, you know, animated. Just that relationship between those two and how it is tested in this film and the arguments that come from that felt so real and raw that, you know, this, you know, surpasses, you know, that barrier of animation. And then same with the kids and their relationship, and then all the themes about, you know, you can call them Randian, I guess, but all the themes about what happens when you celebrate mediocrity and you kind of try and hide away true genius or true
power.
Yeah, power. And what happens when you put that into the hands of somebody who doesn't deserve it, and all these themes that are just incredibly well baked into this film in a way that doesn't feel preachy. It doesn't feel like they are, you know, kind of changing the narrative to get to certain points. It's just everything in this film feels incredibly fluid. And then again, the action is just incredible. So that was completely on accident, not a pun. The Incredibles, my number four for sure.
Hey.
All right. 2 years later, so we get a bit of a hiatus, a one-year hiatus, and then in 2006, we get what I think is a post-apocalyptic thriller. That's Cars. This is clearly a film about anthropomorphized cars that have gained sentience and taken over the world after the fall of mankind, because there are still gas stations, the cars still have doors, so somebody was driving these cars at some point. This is a movie.
Okay. Here we go. Focus. Speed. I am speed. One winner. 42 losers. I eat losers for breakfast.
Colby, as the father of a young child, what are your thoughts on Cars and maybe just the Cars mega franchise?
definitely out of everything that's come before Cars, this was not the one that I thought would spurn the franchise, the next great franchise in Pixar, right? I mean, up until this point, we only had Toy Story 2. And I loved Incredibles so much. I'm like, give me more. Like, the world that you built, I want a place for me. Like, so give me more.
And they were
more.
Like, no, fuck you. How about Cars?
Give you Cars. The thing is, though, is that damn, did I really enjoy Cars.
Yeah.
And it was a time in my life where I was rebuilding a connection with my younger brother after I had, like, you know, graduated from high school and kind of came back home for a little bit. And it was one of the first, it was the first film that I ever took him to in the theater. So just like kind of how you had like the nostalgia feels in regards to Finding Nemo, I had this because this was the first film I took my youngest brother to, and he absolutely loved it. Cars was his thing, and it made me subsequently love it. It really does go like when you, the audience you watch a film with can completely color the way that you feel about it, especially if they're really, really enjoying it. The thing is, when it comes to like cartoons and kids' films, I really don't find it fair to try to critique it from a lens of like a lot of other films. There's got to be some balance to it because it's really not playing by the same rules as a lot of other films are. Like, it'd be weird to try to like hold this up to like Marriage Story. Like, yeah, they're not going to have the same conventions or mechanisms in regards to the narrative structure because it has to do things and hit certain beats to keep kids entertained, you know?
Right.
But I thought the voice cast was a lot of fun, and I thought the story was really cool. I just thought it was a really good time, and actually I have it as number 11 for me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Pretty high.
So I do think that's interesting, that point that you touch on in terms of not necessarily judging children's films the same way that you judge, you know, films like Marriage Story, which is certainly not a children's story. And I think it's interesting because there are a lot of these Pixar films, like I would argue like The Incredibles that we just talked about, that when you do hold them up to those kind of quote unquote, this is, sounds really, you know, mean, but I don't mean it like this, but quote unquote real films,
they
still hold up to that scrutiny.
Yes.
And I do feel like there are certain films in Pixar's library that intentionally aren't trying to do that. The Incredibles very much clearly is. Brad Bird is a filmmaker that clearly had an incredible story that he wanted to tell. Cars kind of takes a different approach and says, look, we just made this goofy kind of stupid.
Like, this is, and the thing is, we have to understand from a historical context, when it came to kids' films, the purpose is to drive commerce to sell toys. And like the art was not first. And Disney and Pixar, no matter what they say, behind closed doors, they're very blunt. Like, we got to sell toys and video games. And while Cars didn't do Toy Story money or Finding Nemo money, it made a lot of money. And I probably argue it probably made some of the best or the most impactful merchandise because I saw Cars stuff everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the only land in Disneyland inspired by a Pixar film. If I'm not, I guess there's like a Bugs Life Land.
Well, now they got the Toy Story.
Oh, you're right.
But that's super brand new. Yeah. But the fact that they did Cars before that, like Toy Story came out at this point a decade before.
Right. Yeah, but I think there are a lot of people that really strongly dislike this movie. I am not one of them, and I'm pleased to hear that you also are not one of them. So yeah, I think this is a perfectly pleasant and lovely film. It is middle of the road Pixar for me. I have it at number 16, which again is still anywhere from good to great. We're sitting right there. So yeah, I mean, I don't get the Cars hate is what I'm saying.
At least from Cars 1. Yeah.
So, and it's interesting to talk about, you know, Cars right after Incredibles, and then right before this next film, which is another Brad Bird film, in 2007, we got Ratatouille, which is clearly the story about a rat with psychic powers who is able to control humans with his mind. It's the only possible way that this film makes sense.
In the past, I have made no secret of my disdain for Chef Gusteau's famous motto, "Anyone can cook," but I realize only now do I truly understand what he meant. Not everyone can become a great artist, but a great artist can come from anywhere.
But this is a film that basically sells no merchandise because nobody's going to buy a rat. Although, side mark, I think I did actually one time when I went to Disneyland when I was a kid, I bought like a Remy the Rat stuffed animal. So, but this is a film that is very much more like a film that's trying to have a message and not to sell toys.
Yeah.
So, Colby, what's your thoughts on Ratatouille?
I love this movie. One, I'm a foodie.
Nice.
I thought the music was great, and man, it really knows how to hit you in the feels. And then this had a very strong antagonist, and I think as I'm looking more and more, inside of like my top 10, you're gonna start seeing like that theme. I really enjoyed the playfulness of this film, the two different worlds kind of colliding, and then ultimately this friendship and this bond because they both needed one another. I think the voice cast is really great, and I have Ratatouille at my number 7 spot.
Number 7. Awesome. Again, right there with you. I love Ratatouille. I think it is one of the most underappreciated films in Pixar's library for sure. This is the most recent film that I have rewatched other than Onward, of course. My girlfriend, hi Dana, had not seen Ratatouille. And so I was like, you have to see this movie. This is a movie. I don't want to be that person that's always like, oh, you have to see this movie. But I thought this movie was, it's just what it does in terms of having a theme that is so underappreciated, but so important. And this idea that I every time I see a rat, like when I'm just walking around the streets of Boston and I see a rat, I'll point at it and scream, anybody can cook, because that message is just so powerfully explained in this movie. And I love it. And then, of course, you've got everything else that makes a Pixar movie so good. You've got the side characters that are hilarious. You've got Will Arnett in a French accent playing the one of the chefs who just, lies about how he killed a man every time or something like that. I don't
really
know.
Good.
And then the level of detail and just I could not believe how well this movie held up. It's from 2007, but it looks like it was filmed last year. It looks beautiful and it's hilarious, and I absolutely love this movie. So this is my number 3.
Oh, nice.
So then after that, we start churning out these movies about once a year for the next like decade almost, which, I mean, given the quality at this point, I think that's pretty incredible. They're successfully churning these movies out once every year. In 2008, we get WALL-E. Eve. This is the film about how you can score a girl completely out of your league if you're the only one left on Earth.
Bam.
Come on, Eve's way out of Wally's league, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. So, Colby, what are your thoughts on WALL-E?
I mean, it's probably, I think at this point, Pixar is leaning into something where they know they can do things a little bit differently. Like I said, I don't think Ratatouille ever went in with like, let's sell toys, because just inherently that story wasn't about that. With WALL-E, I think they said, okay, I think we can do both here. But I mean, this is probably one of the strongest first acts of, like, I prefer the first half of WALL-E much more than the second half. And that's saying something, because I think the second half is really strong as well. But this had a commentary on like our society. And I think this is the first film that really, really dug into that. Like, this was, is this movie really what it's about? Like,
yeah,
like, you know, it's obviously it was about like, you know, the way that we treat our world and stuff like that. But then it was also the way that we treat ourselves. And it's a really strong message. And this was beautiful. Like, I think like the sound mix and design in this film is like really, really impressive. I remember when I watched it in theaters, I'm like, yo, this is not a kid's film. And honestly, I think it was probably a bit too mature in the first part. It's like a very long short film that you would get at the beginning of a Pixar film, you know.
It's kind
of
like a silent film too for about
really
the first 30
minutes. And that can be really unnerving for little kids. So they had to be clever in putting little things that brought out the comedy, you know, because you don't get, I mean, you get Eve quick, but like not like right out the gate, you know. So it just really was all on this little garbage picking robot. And it's incredibly sweet. And I actually have WALL-E inside my top 10. I have it right behind Ratatouille at number 8.
Awesome. WALL-E for me is also in my top 10. It is my number 7 film.
Okay.
And I think what's great about this film is that Pixar is starting to realize that they can kind of experiment, like you said, but also just get away with things and not really tell us what they're actually doing, mm-hmm. and just trusting that people will go see their movies. I haven't seen the WALL-E trailer for a long time, but I had no idea that this was going to be about environmentalism. And
no one did. This was a shock to a lot of people.
And so you see the trailer and you're like, oh, it's this dinky little adorable robot that has, you know, these quirky qualities. But then from that, they start bringing in all these new things about what happens when we start relying too heavily on technology and what happens to the earth and what happens when, you know, we start abusing the earth. And I mean, it's a crazy concept for a kid's movie again, which maybe it's less of a kid's movie than something like Cars again, but it certainly is animated and it is for children on some level. And so to be able to make a film that is this powerful for, you know, for that type of film is fantastic. So WALL-E easily up in my top 10. So that was 2008. And then in 2009, we see the release of Up, which is essentially a 5-minute short film that they just padded an extra 91 minutes to the end of so that you had time to dry out your eyes before leaving the theater. But no, actually, it is a 96-minute movie with an entire plot that isn't just going to make you cry in the first 5 minutes.
My master made me this collar. He is a good and smart master, and he made me this collar so that I may talk. Squirrel!
Colby, after the first 5 minutes, what are your thoughts on Up?
The strongest 5 minutes of the entire Pixar cinematic universe, their entire catalog. I mean, just even you sell this as a short film, and it could have won the Oscar. When did Best Animated Feature come into play?
That was like 2001, because I think Shrek was the first animated feature film winner. Yeah.
Did this win Best Animated Feature?
It had to, because it was nominated for Best Picture, I believe, too.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so then I'm just going to give it that. It could have won Best Short Film. It could have won like a bunch of stuff. It's an incredibly strong opening to a film. It has a really solid rest of the first act and second act. I don't know. I think I'm in the minority with this one, but I don't know why. I'm just there's something about the hokiness of the third act that lost me a bit, because the first act is so poignant, and it kind of lost that the rest of the way, and it was still fun. So like, I have this at my number 9, but in regards to balance, it's a little bit more lopsided, but it's not a fault, because it's like, it's lopsided because it's just the most strongest opening of almost any film ever, you know?
Yeah, totally fair. I love Doug in this film. He shoots it up for me quite a bit.
Squirrel.
Hilarious just concept and yes. Alpha having that broken vocal collar and everything. Great, great little details like that. The hokiness that you talk about, there is a part where Carl has to kind of scale the side of a blimp at one point to save this bird. If I have to scale the side of a blimp for a bird, fuck that bird. That bird is dead. I am not scaling the side of a blimp, especially as like a geriatric 80 plus year old man. No, thank you. So, this film, it's really touching. I really love the relationship between Carl and I can't remember the kid's name, Russell, maybe.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, just a great relationship there. And again, a great message and a really interesting premise, even though if you start to think about literally how many balloons would be needed to float a house, the premise of this movie doesn't make sense at all. But that being said, it's just in my top 10 at number 10.
Okay.
All right. So now we start moving into what I'm going to call Pixar's fuck you, I want money phase, where most of their movies are just sequels or prequels or spinoffs or whatever. Fortunately, this starts with, in my opinion, an excellent sequel. This is 2010's Toy Story 3.
You got a lot to look forward to, folks. The little ones love new toys. What a nice bear.
And he smells like strawberries.
What are your thoughts, Colby?
Well, definitely the I Want Money, because I didn't know that we needed a Toy Story 3. Somehow they lucked up in... I don't know how they did it, but they lucked up in delivering on the story, progressing these toy story characters forward. We really thought that their stories were done. And I mean, it delivered probably one of the most impactful, you know, last 15 minutes of a film in their catalog. And it's incredibly strong. It's brilliantly voice acted. And I mean, the visuals are absolutely stunning. So yeah, Toy Story 3, rightfully so. I don't want to say it's overrated. I think it's definitely properly rated. It's at my number four.
Number four. Wow. So yeah. that is higher than one and two, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. I have Toy Story 3 higher as one and two.
Yeah. So same for me. This is higher than one and two for me. This is my number eight film. Agree with everything that you said. Toy Story 3 is my Toy Story, I would say. It was around the time that I was getting ready to kind of start moving on from growing up and things like that. So mm-hmm. I very much related. You know, Andy's a little older than I was at that time, but yeah, this film, somehow they managed to do the impossible and make a third Toy Story relevant. And I mean, not to jump a couple films, but they did that again with Toy Story 4. So
I know, you know, crazy.
If they're going to make Toy Stories, I trust them at this point. So
oh, yeah.
Let's talk about when I don't trust Pixar. We have hit a bump in the road in 2011 with Cars 2.
I never properly introduced myself. Finn MacMissile, British intelligence.
Co-mater. Average intelligence.
Is that what we're calling it?
A bump? Yeah, a bump in the road. You like the pun? Because cars drive on roads.
Love
Colby.
It. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah, so this is kind of known as Pixar's first actual dud. It is, a lot of people call it their first genuinely bad film. And for that reason, I have not seen this film. And I have no intentions of seeing it. There are a lot of other films that I can see instead of it. So for me, it's 22. Just, you know, because, or I shouldn't even rank it. It's not fair to rank it if I haven't seen it. But what are your thoughts on Cars 2, Colby?
Number 21.
Okay.
That is my thoughts.
Okay. All right. Interested to see what's number 22. But let's move on. So after that, in 2012, we get Brave, in which a young girl overcomes her speech impediment to become Queen of the Bears. That's what I remember about this.
Pretend I'm Merida. Speak to me. What would you say?
I can't do this.
Sure you can. There. That's my queen. Right, here we go. I don't want to get married. I want to stay single and let my hair flow in the wind as I ride through the glen, firing arrows into the sunset.
Obviously doesn't have a speech impediment. That's very mean. She is Scottish or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember this movie being incredibly average, and I was not a fan. What are your thoughts?
It's a really pretty movie, and mm-hmm. it's oh, man, it sucks. Like, one, 2000, so I had a lot of things going on in 2012. Like, I birthed my kid out that, well, I didn't birth my kid. My wife did. Shout out to the Mrs. Mac. so it's like, this wasn't on my purview at all, but I remember, like, having to sell the merchandise when I was an assistant manager of a Subway. And I was like, what the hell is this movie about? Who is this movie for? Like, and it sucks because, like, you know, we didn't have films strictly marketed for, like, you know, to try to get girl audiences there. And I think that Merida is a very strong girl character. I think for representation, this film worked a lot. It's a pretty looking film. It looks really, really, really good. And I love a lot of the traditional aspects of, like, the indigenous songs and stuff like that that was included in the culture. But there's no really, like, worthwhile antagonist. And that just kind of rided on me. So when I watched it, I'm like, okay, it's kind of inconsequential. So I've got it at number 18.
Okay. Yeah, it's number 20 for me. I just, for whatever reason, and I think this movie genuinely would have worked better if they had kept it with the original director. I cannot remember her name, but it was originally going to be helmed by a female director. And it feels like there was just this mismatch of stuff that didn't work out. You know, you've got this, what I believe the central theme of the original film was going to be, was this relationship between the mother and the daughter, Merida. Mm-hmm. But then they start introducing all this random crap about, it's sort of got like a brother bear thing going on where somebody turns into bears. It's a sloppy movie, but you're right. It is beautiful. And I think that that's going to be the thing from here on out, that no matter what I feel about these movies, they are gorgeous, gorgeous films.
Oh yeah.
So after 2012, we are in 2013, and Pixar is actually nice enough to celebrate me graduating high school by releasing Monsters University.
Hello, I'm Terry with a Y.
And I'm Terry with an I. I'm a dance major.
And I'm not.
5, 6, 7, 8. Do, 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 7, 8, turn!
And turn.
Why didn't you turn?
Because we never agreed to do this.
You said this was going to be cool.
No one said this was going to be cool.
Now I'm embarrassed.
Now you're embarrassed.
Yes, because it's in front of people.
You should wake up embarrassed.
This is the prequel story to Monsters, Inc. that teaches kids the important lesson that sometimes you just suck at things and there is nothing you can do about it. And I'm kind of kidding, but that literally is the message of this movie, which is pretty incredible to me. I actually really love this movie, and part of it is because it came out the same year I started college. So let's start with the unbiased thoughts first. Colby, what are your thoughts on Monsters University?
I thought it was fun. It was great being able to see these characters back, Sully and Mike. And, you know, it was cool to try to remember, like, oh, like, this is cool. This is what they were doing a few years before they got, like, into the swing of their stuff and everything like that. It felt like this is definitely one of those we didn't need it. But, like, I'm glad that we got it, right? I don't think that it elevated the, you know, the Monsters, Inc. mythos more. Much, I would definitely, I'm a guy that I like to go forward as opposed to going back, unless, like, it's absolutely essential. And it just, yeah, it didn't stick with me like I would have liked it to. So I have it at number 16.
Okay. This is my stir the pot number. I have it at number 5 just because.
Oh, whoa. Okay.
I want it in my top 5. That might be a bit hyperbolic, but I do genuinely love this film. And I really think that that message of it's okay to be okay is something that you do not see in children's movies.
Yeah.
That you do not see the message that, look, there are things that maybe you want to do, but you can't do them. And no matter how hard you try, you are just not going to do certain things. And it's kind of a heartbreaking message. But the fact that Mike moves on and he becomes a pivotal character in Monsters, Inc. And, you know, he eventually does come to be a great stand-up comedian or, you know, whatever that the end of Monsters, Inc. shows is it's really powerful to me. And I also was just a sucker for the G-rated version of college that you see in this film. So, yeah, super biased, but Monsters University is my number 5. So at me, please. It's good for the like the algorithm.
Yes.
All right. Inside Out. This was we got 2 years of a hiatus before they released Inside Out in 2015.
You made it. Go save Riley.
Take her to the moon for me. Okay.
This, as far as I'm concerned, is a masterpiece of a film. But I'll let you take it away first. Colby, what are your thoughts on Inside Out?
Yeah, it was tough. I remember when I saw the trailer the first time, I'm like, wow, this is interesting because this reminded me a lot of what Toy Story did visually. Toy Story changed the game. And after seeing Cars 2 and Brave and Monsters University, it's not that we kind of lost hope in Pixar. We're just like, man, I wonder what this is going to be. Whoa.
Yep.
Okay. All right. I'm looking at the talent. I'm like, okay. And I'm seeing the trailer. All right. Then you're watching the movie. This is fun. Love the world. Exploring. What if our thoughts had their own thoughts and emotions? And what if our emotions were really driving us? And we're like these machines. And it really navigated, you know, what being a preteen was like, especially in a transition and moving. And it did. I love it when these kids' films can incorporate the parents. Because for a lot of times when I grew up as a kid, parents were kind of either gone or there was only one of them. And it's almost like they didn't matter. And I love how these parents, while they're not the focus of the film, they were still greatly a part of this story. And I love the balance because you kind of see these emotions being parental figures in a sense, how they're driving, you know, our lead character. And I mean, this is where Pixar said, okay, we are going to emotionally manipulate you. Like, this is what we're going to do. We tried the fun stuff and everything like that. But, like, now we're going to use these next films that are going to be coming with a couple of, like, hiccups along the way. And we're just going to murder you. And I can't say his name. Bing Bong.
Bing Bong. Yeah.
I mean, come on. It's and you know what's crazy? I have this film so high and there's not a central antagonist to this.
Nope.
There just really, really isn't. It's my number 2 Pixar film.
All right.
It is a It's an absolutely, like, I have it as a 10 out of 10.
It is also my number two. It is also a 10 out of 10 for me.
10 out of 10, man.
I fucking love this movie, man.
So good.
The lack of a central antagonist is what just absolutely makes this film work. It is, you know, you think that sadness is going to be this antagonistic force early on in the film. And then what it ends up coming out and saying about sadness and how important that is in just being a healthy human being, how you can't be,
you need it.
You can't be mentally healthy without being sad and or having, you know, the access to the emotion of sadness. Mm-hmm. And just everything about not only the world building, you know, that's all, it's almost crazy to kind of like hand wave that away because we expect that from Pixar, but just the message of what it's like to have emotions and how different emotions can and different memories can be both happy and sad and the complexity of that. And I just think that that's incredible. And one of the things I really love about this film is that when you take a step back and you look at Riley and her situation, it's like, okay, I mean, it's not that serious of a situation. Yeah. Like no one's dying. It's not like the world isn't ending or anything like that. It is this girl, she's a teenager and it's a very real problem that she's having and probably a problem that literally everybody in the world can empathize with in some way, of feeling isolated or feeling like you miss home or you're uprooted from the foundation that you grew up with. So it's also saying that, look, we're not going to over dramatize this. We're not going to say, oh man, wow, wouldn't it be crazy if this girl was, you know, she had cancer or something. This is something that is showing the complexity of every day-to-day life. And I think that that's why Inside Out is a masterpiece. And if it wasn't for Finding Nemo's nostalgia, then Inside Out, I mean, it's just an incredible film. And anybody who hasn't seen it, go see it. Like, holy shit. If you don't cry or like at least blubber up a little bit or something, you're dead inside.
Oh, yeah.
So then only a couple, Inside Out, huge high. I'm like, okay, yes, you know, there were some hiccups, even though I loved Monsters University, I acknowledge that it's, you know, it's not doing the exact same things that something like Inside Out are. So we're really high on this. And then in 2015, we get The Good Dinosaur.
He likes you.
Imagine that, Ramsay, even with your stinky face.
Smash boundaries. This is my personal bubble.
Nah, that ain't your bubble. This is your bubble!
Nash, get out of your sister's bubble.
This is a film where I'm sure a lot of people who are listening have not seen this movie, so I shit you not, a dinosaur and a feral child get high on fermented rotting fruits. That happens in this movie. Colby Mack. Thoughts on The Good Dinosaur.
This is my absolute number 22 ranked Pixar film.
All right.
And this is most certainly a certified stinker. When I watched this film with my little girl, she's like, what is going on here? Why did you take me to this movie? What's up with this sad dinosaur? That's the name of the movie, The Sad Dinosaur, not The Good Dinosaur. Yeah. This sad, just absolutely draining story. And it's, I don't, just the animation style, the choice of, you know, characterizing this dinosaur in this way. I don't like it. It's got a lot of stuff going on and it didn't feel right. The thing is though, outside of the character design, a lot of the other elements visually like were really good. I just couldn't care anything about this story.
Yeah.
You know, and there's so many dinosaur movies, like you really got to bring it home. Like I'm a Land Before Time kind of guy and I stuck through all 10 of those bad boys. Okay. So.
Damn. We watched a lot of those when we were kids, but I didn't see those last couple ones, man.
Oh yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. They definitely got redundant, but I mean the first three or four, whew, oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, so this movie feels more like a VFX reel or like a really expensive way to try and do some really cool animation because I think it's not even a selling point because this movie, for what I know, bombed. But the kind of the thing that stuck out about this movie was that it was almost hyper-realistic, the backgrounds. So you had these like very cartoonish characters moving around in what in some ways felt like actual Wyoming, which is pretty crazy. And that is gorgeous. But yeah, it doesn't work at all as a film. And, you know, that gets old pretty quickly. So this is my number 18. Just because I do like what it's doing with the elements of nature and kind of making that or so hyper realistic. I really like that. And then there's a couple other films that we haven't talked about that that really pissed me off. So The Good Dinosaur did not piss me off. Speaking of a film that did piss me off, in 2016, Pixar releases Finding Dory.
Hi, Dory.
Ahoy there. Do you want to play hide and seek?
Okay.
We'll hide and you count and come find us.
Okay, Daddy.
No, no, not Daddy. I'm the nice fish who wants to be your friend. Okay?
Okay, Daddy.
No.
I'm hiding.
Now count to 10.
This is the second Pixar sequel to break $1 billion at the global box office. And I was obviously stupid hyped for this movie because it is a sequel to one of my favorite movies of all time. Thoroughly disappointed by it. I thought it, in some cases, completely jumped the shark by having an octopus drive a truck. And there was just, I was just very disappointed by coming back to this well and the output that it had. But Colby, thoughts on Finding Dory?
Yeah, well, with where I had Finding Nemo ranked and kind of using that as my frame of reference going in, did this need a sequel? I don't know if I can call this a sequel. It is.
Yeah.
But the suspension of disbelief that's needed to really appreciate this film, and granted it's a cartoon movie, I just felt like it was such a stretch, and you're right, it jumped the shark. And it's funny. I think it's definitely an enjoyable movie, but Dory wasn't like a really big character that I gravitated too much in the original, so I didn't really have a long leash for this film, so this is at my number 17.
Yeah. Okay. And sorry, remind me what Finding Nemo was for you?
Yep. So Finding Nemo was number 14.
Okay. Yeah. So Finding Dory for me is number 19. So a huge fall for me, like minus 18 places on the sequel. And yeah, this movie genuinely felt like a film that was made for the Disney Junior crowd. So yeah. Not even like, you know, the 10 or 11 year olds or whatever. This felt like it was for 4 year olds that just like pretty colors. And if you put an octopus that's red on screen, then they're going to be entertained for an hour. So very, very disappointed here.
Yeah. I mean, and then to think about, you know, you had, you know, before this film, you had Inside Out. And once again, I feel like the bar had been raised again. And then we just kind of like, we had The Good Dinosaur and that didn't work. And then we had Finding Dory. I'm like, guys, like, you know what you just did before, right?
Yeah.
So it's so tough. So I felt like I think maybe I was harder on the studio because I expected more.
Yeah, completely agree. And again, for me, because it's Finding Nemo franchise, I guess, that like, come on. If you're going to come back to this, I need something great. So a year later, we get in 2017, we get Cars 3.
Hey, Jackson Storm, right? Great race today.
Wow. Thank you, Mr. McQueen. You have no idea what a pleasure it is for me to finally beat you.
Oh, thanks. Wait, hang on. Did you say meet or beat?
I think you heard me.
This is a film that I did not watch in theaters. I watched it when it came on Netflix, like, you know, 2 years ago or
same.
Whatever.
Same.
This film feels like it's borrowing themes from a Scorsese film, but yep. It happens to be about cars. And by what I mean by that is that this film is very interested in legacy and the idea of aging and transitioning from being an athlete to being a coach. And I think this film was a little more effective on me than others because in 2017 I had, or, you know, when I saw this in 2018 or whatever, I had just had a very close coach of mine pass away. So I was very reflective of what his legacy was on me and other athletes that he had coached. So this film was very important to me for that. But even with that, the mismatch of this and some of the more like herpy derp, I'm Mater, and kind of, you know, there's a whole scene in this where they're like doing like a mud rodeo with like an angry school bus. It just doesn't work. And I think that, you know, if Pixar was really gutsy and they had decided to go full Scorsese, for lack of a better word, I guess, with Cars 3, you could have gotten something really incredible here. For me, it sits at 17. It's not awful by any means, but it's 17. So bottom of the pack for me.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I'm not too far behind you there. I have it at number 19. Definitely better than Cars 2. I'd say that. but still, like, in, you know, the fact that I have the first Cars right outside of my top 10, it's still nowhere near kind of really gets to where that was. And I think it's a tough property to kind of crack because it is so, I want to say out there. It's just, it's the most cartoony of it. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah. it can lend itself to working better as a stretched out TV series, you know, or like just like those individual one-off cartoons as opposed to a feature film.
Yeah, completely agree. So then later in 2017, we get Coco.
It's red, ay mi amor, ay mi amor. Where should I put my shoes, ay mi amor, you say put them on your head, ay mi amor.
This is a great film that is an all Latino cast about the Day of the Dead. Colby, thoughts on Coco?
Man, talk about an absolutely stellar. I mean, we're back to So you guys did remember how you did Inside Out. Great. Because
it's like Whiplash.
When I heard of Coco, I got a little turned off by it. Because obviously we had just consecutive films of just Good Dinosaur, Finding Dory, Cars 3 for me, right? And there was a film that came out a couple years before called The Book of Life. But we're back to a truly visually stunning picture. The music is great. I mean, come on. These songs are incredible. Really, and this did it for me. So, Coco at number three.
Number three. Wow. That's awesome.
Yes, sir.
I agree with you. I think Coco is another, it's like, for every Cars 3, well, that's too mean to Cars 3, but for every Cars 3, there's a Coco. And I thought that this film, again, was a return to form, and that just that single image of when he first gets into the land of the dead and sees that entire, I don't even know what you call it, but it's sort of like the like towers of houses and all the colors. It's just,
the design is so cool.
That scene alone, Jesus Christ, so good. And then again, the message about how I thought it was beautiful how music was used as a way to remember people and as a way to help like improve Coco's memory, and how she used that as a way to remember her father. And then again, just I don't want to keep tying it back to the same thing, but this again was around the time when somebody very close to me passed away, and I was starting to think about how they're remembered and how you appreciate them and what happens when people stop thinking about the people who have passed on. So there's some really layered things in here. This number is going to seem very large for all the positivity that I just gave, but that, again, we keep saying this is just a testament to the quality of films that Pixar makes. So Coco for me is number 12, but I would still consider this a great to fantastic film.
I'll absolutely accept that.
So we are getting pretty close to the end here. This is now the 20th film from Pixar. This is 2018's The Incredibles 2.
Because I'm formulating, okay? I'm taking in information, I'm processing, I'm doing the math, I'm fixing the boyfriend and keeping the baby from turning into a flaming monster. How do I do it? By rolling with the punches, baby. I eat thunder and crap lightning, okay? Because I'm Mr. Incredible, not Mr. So-So or Mr. Mediocre Guy, Mr. Incredible.
This is a film that is essentially just The Incredibles, but they increase the volume of everyone's lines by two. Colby, this is your number. The Incredibles was your number one film. What are your thoughts on Incredibles 2?
My number 13.
13. Okay.
And that seems like such a far separation. I mean, you look at your number one film to where, you know, Finding Dory was. And I think it's because when it worked so well, it is going to be super challenging to try to improve on that. And keep in mind, probably about 30 minutes ago, I said, I want so much more from that from that world, right? Yeah. And I mean, keep in mind, we kind of pick up not far from where we left off. The thing is, though, is that I have now, like, I'm so much further from where this film left off. I mean, what are we talking, like 15 plus years?
Yeah.
You know, from when this film came out, from 2004 to 2018. So yeah, 14 years. So I almost wish the characters would have progressed, but then I understand just the financials behind keeping those characters the same. Like, I completely got it. But I felt like it kind of was stunted in the stories that it was able to tell, and it pretty much just ended up being like The Incredibles all over. The thing is that when it's the number one film and you're going to do that all over again and you're going to just increase the volume on everything, well, you're not going to do it bad. It's just not going to be as special. So, yeah, it's at number 13.
I think I do agree with you on everything. My number is much lower than that, though. And granted, okay, Incredibles was what? I think my number three film? Number four. And I have this at number 21. This film.
Oh, wow.
And I think this may be a byproduct of expectations.
Mm-hmm.
As well as the fact that a lot of people were very positive on this film. And so because of that, I had even higher hopes for this, that I was like, okay, this is, let's look at the facts. Brad Bird has never made a sequel to his films before this. And he explicitly said he would not be returning to this film unless he had a story he wanted to tell. It baffles me that 14 years later, this is the story that he chose to tell. Because for all the reasons you just said, it feels like a rehash because they just started from the exact moment that it left off. It felt like all these characters were literally in arrested development while the rest of the world grew and our understanding of superheroes evolved because of things like the MCU. And it felt like a complete missed opportunity. And not only was it a missed opportunity in that way, it just wasn't as remotely as creative. The villain I thought in here was A, incredibly predictable, speaking of twists,
yeah,
and B, nowhere near as compelling or didn't even really have a side that I could understand, like Buddy or Syndrome or whatever from Incredibles 1.
Yeah.
So this film just disappointed me on every level. And I tried to see it a second time to give it a second chance and be more open to it and know what was coming and, you know, not expecting these kind of pivotal things. But it just, this film completely disappointed in me in probably a bigger way than Finding Dory. So I, and then, you know, you have a film that comes out that same year called Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. We have talked about this film together before. I was scared out of my mind that Incredibles 2 would get the Oscar over Spider-Verse. I was so happy that that was not the case. So that just sort of kind of piled onto my probably hyperbolic distaste for this movie. But Incredibles 2, 21, and I'm very confident with that.
Hey, I'll take it, bro. Good job. All right.
I'm going to get off my soapbox. Last year in 2019, we got Toy Story 4.
All right, Forky, you have to understand how lucky you are right now. You're Bonnie's toy. You are going to help create happy memories that will last for the rest of her life.
Huh? What?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Doing it for Bonnie. Doing this for Bonnie. Doing it for Bonnie. Okay. Like it or not, you are a toy. Maybe you don't like being one, but you are one nonetheless, which means you are going to be there for Andy when he...
Who's Andy?
So this, again, was a film that has really no reason to exist other than the fact that it's a really good film. We didn't need it, but we got it anyways, and I thought it was fantastic. Colby, what are your thoughts on Toy Story 4?
Yeah, bro, you are absolutely right. It really is fantastic, and I didn't have any hopes for it. I got a chance to see it in London when I was on vacation and saw it in like the biggest IMAX screen that I ever did.
Wow.
And it was just like really, really, really powerful, which I didn't think it had any business being because I thought we were done. Like Toy Story 3 was a great ending. And it's the number three. Like, You don't do a four for what? You know, it's right. Definitely not a movie that we asked for, but it's a movie that we ended up needing. It's just another masterfully animated Pixar film. It blew me away. Like it is, I mean, just Pixar and Water is absolutely like stunning. There's really yep. nothing like it. And there's so many moments inside that film that are just truly outstanding. And it's a poignant story. And it's from these characters that we all grew up with. And the good thing is that unlike with Incredibles 2, even though their ages don't change, I can see how their personality has changed so much. And it's changed along with me. It's changed about life and with their identity. And it's the perfect ending for Woody. This is Woody's ending. This is his swan song. You know, and because now I can trust that, you know, Pixar will get any Toy Story movie right. Do not undo what you did and have Woody return. He's good. This movie will make you laugh. It'll make you definitely cry and probably has the strongest last line in any Pixar movie. And those little ending credit stuff, that doesn't count. But that does not count. When Rex says to him, "Oh, is Woody gonna be a lost toy?" And my boy Buzz says, "No, he's not lost." and then Woody says, "To infinity." And Buzz says, "And beyond." My gosh, I broke, bro. I lost it. I'm like, I don't know how you could write anything better. I truly don't get it. You weren't the only one, man.
I didn't Tom Hanks cry when he read this?
Oh, my God.
I think that was the... Yeah. So where does this rank for you?
Oh, yeah. I guess I should get to that point, right? This. Yeah. That gets to my number. I think it's number five.
Number five. Yes. Wow. And so that was just
right after Toy Story 3. So I got Toy Story 4 and number three spot. Toy Story 4, number five. Toy Story 3, and number four.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. I agree with everything you said. Toy Story 4 for me is number 11. So just a little bit below Toy Story 3, just sitting on the outside looking at that top 10. But I completely agree with everything you say. I think some of the new characters are fantastic, like Ducky and Bunny.
Oh,
that
my gosh. Yes.
Recurring gag of them attacking the old lady. I can't remember a
and
time
that shouldn't
I've last
have worked.
Harder.
It shouldn't have worked.
No.
It really, really shouldn't. And damn it did. And Forky, come on. Forky.
Yeah, Forky.
Duke Kaboom.
I thought Forky was going to be like grating and obnoxious, but he was not. He was perfect for what, you know, his role in the story was.
Yes.
And so he was great.
Yeah. And I mean, Tony Hale, like he's a phenomenal voice actor. He's a comedic genius, and being able to incorporate, Keanu Reeves in this and Duke Kaboom, yep. It was just, you knew exactly what you wanted from him. He completely delivers. And you know, and then you still didn't, I mean, I don't want to say you gave a shaft to like a lot of the other characters, but I think they had their time. I mean, RC, you only see him in like the first, you know, few minutes of the film, you know, and then bringing Bo Peep back and making her complete badass. Like, come on.
Yeah, I was going to say the one downside of having the characters like Ducky and Bunny is that you do get, you know, characters like Jesse and to an extent Buzz, they get a little shafted in this.
Sure.
So with that being said, if they make a Toy Story 5, I agree with you. Woody's done. Don't bring him back. Focus on those characters and whatever they get up to without Woody. I think that would be the way that they should go for a Toy Story 5. And based on the amount of money this made, I don't see why they wouldn't do a Toy Story 5. So, and I will certainly trust them to do a Toy Story 5, whatever they do. All right. Last but not least, or at least not last for me, or at least not least for me, is Pixar's 22nd film. That was this year's Onward. I will just actually read an actual synopsis for this one very quickly. Two teenage elf brothers, Ian and Barley Lightfoot, go on a journey to discover if there is still magic left out there in order to spend one last day with their father, who died when they were too young to remember him. The film stars Tom Holland and Chris Pratt. It is written by Dan Scanlon, Jason Headley, Keith Bunnan, and it is directed by Monsters University's Dan Scanlon.
In times of old, the world was full of wonder and magic. But times change.
I'm a mighty warrior!
Morning, Mom!
Hey, birthday boy!
By the laws of yore, I must dub thee a man today. Kneel before me.
That's okay.
I have a gift from your dad. He
just said to give you this when you were both over 16.
No way! It's a wizard staff. Dad was a wizard.
What? Your dad was an accountant.
This spell brings him back. For one whole day, Dad will be back.
What?
Back, like back to life? That's not possible.
It is with this.
I'm gonna meet Dad.
I definitely remember Dad having a top part.
Oh, what did I do?
So, Colby, what are your thoughts on Pixar's latest?
Damn it, you Pixar, you did it again. These emotionally manipulative monsters, how dare they fool me into thinking that this was just going to be some middle-of-the-road, mundane, DreamWorks-esque style movie? Because let me tell you something, that trailer, like when we first heard about this Otter movie a year ago, I'm like, okay. It's Pixar. They just got finished doing Toy Story 4. Let's do Onward. Oh, Tom Holland and Chris Pratt. All right, let's go. I get this first trailer. There was something about this trailer, which is crazy because it's set in this fantastical world full of magical and mythical monsters, and I felt no magic. And there was something about the visual styling, because we're coming off of Toy Story 4, brilliant visuals, where I'm just like, oh, it doesn't look as good as Toy Story 4. And maybe we shouldn't treat it like that. Like, we shouldn't treat, like, keep in mind, all these properties are going to be inherently different, but that's just the bar that they set, and it's crazy high. And while the animation still isn't on Toy Story 4 or Inside Out or Coco levels, it's far from the stock in middling, you know, studio adding that I thought we were going to get. And it started a bit rocky in, like, the first act, right? And then it kept going. It didn't have the oomph that I was used to. It didn't have the oomph of Up, right? It didn't have the oomph of Toy Story 4 in the beginning. But then when it gets going, it really gets going. This magical bro journey really starts soaring and taking off. And like, it fully embraces the fantasy genre, which I love. I love that it pokes fun and makes fun of it, of itself. It's really meta in its takes, and there's a lot of comedy to be had with it. I saw this in Dolby, hashtag Kobe does Dolby. It looks and sounds like amazing. And yo, shout out to Chris Pratt and Tom Holland. They do a really great job with their voice work. I love the chemistry between them. Like I said, it was a little rocky in the beginning, but then you can really start feeling them getting comfortable as the story progresses. And it's a road trip movie, and it still finds a way to be about these two brothers. And somehow, Dan Scanlon sneakily packs in this powerful exploration of brotherhood, of manhood, even fatherhood in this kid's film. And it'll just knock you out. And honestly, I believe that this is the best third act, the entire best third act of a Pixar movie.
I agree with that. Yeah, I think this is actually what I would describe it as, is it's a fairly average film with a really great ending. And I think the film has a ton of heart, and the emotional beats of the film work really well. Surprisingly, or maybe not because it's Pixar, but surprisingly, the emotional beats of the film are the best part of the film, in the sense that I feel like the plot and a lot of the world building things, which I'm usually very attuned to and that I usually really love in these types of Pixar films, is lacking. I think what really works for this is that relationship between Chris Pratt's character and Tom Holland's character. Yeah. And those are the moments that I'm most interested in the movie. And so while it is a film that, you know, it's not a sequel or anything, so it is technically an original story, it's not necessarily an original movie. Yeah, a lot of the world building feels a little weaker than some other Pixar films. And it honestly feels like Dan Scanlon just wanted to tell a story about two human brothers and tell this story that maybe they go on a road trip. And I don't, you know, based on the central themes of this film, it seems weird. Like, you don't need to have this whole fantasy aspect to it. There can still be magic in a film, even if it's not fantasy-esque. So I thought that it was almost distracting to include all this world buildy stuff, but Pixar was probably like, no, we need a hook. And I think that it is a bit of a distraction in the film. But that being said, music's good, animation's good. It is a very good film. And me saying that I was a little underwhelmed by some of the world building stuff is, again, more a testament to how good Pixar is doing in those categories in films like Finding Nemo or The Incredibles or whatever.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. Well, I think there's a lot left on the table in this movie. Yeah. And it's crazy because, like, I rate this, like, my personal rating is a 9 out of 10 with this film. And like I said, it's that's what most of this conversation, it's a testament to how brilliant Pixar is as a studio, because, like, I would have just taken an hour and a half film of just exploring this world. Like,
right.
They did it so quickly. In the first 5 minutes of the movie, I feel like, wow, we kind of glossed over this really quickly. But this had a commentary on how technology has warped the, like, the real beauty to just, like, the natural things in the world. And this mythical world, they have these natural beasts and creatures and magic, and conveniences have distorted the identities that they had in themselves. And I would have loved an exploration of trying to recapture that. And they kind of do in certain parts, but ultimately the story was focused on, you know, Ian and Barley. And yeah, it felt kind of like, like the hissing unicorns that are like raccoons. I'm like, that is so cool. But we don't get enough of it, right? Like, and it's crazy because I listened to, you know, to you on your guest spot on Mike, Mike and Oscar. I'm like, yo, you guys are hitting everything that I was talking about. But yet it's so crazy because I can see those emotional beats coming a mile away and they still freaking worked on me. Like they still, like, I'm like, I turned to my wife over watching and we're just looking at each other and our eyes are welling up and my lip is quivering. I'm like, they're going to do it. They're going to die. Oh gosh. But you're right. This could easily be like an indie drama in like a live action setting. And like, you've seen this type of film before, you know, two brothers that may have been estranged and they're forced to be inside of this, you know, small condensed space. And they're going towards a goal that they think is a common goal, but don't realize that they were the goal all along.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, like you said, those emotional beats, they're not novel necessarily. They're not, I mean, maybe the idea of the brotherly love is a bit novel, but it's not like you don't see it coming, and it's not like there's this massive third act twist, even though it's sort of set up like that, I guess, a little. But like, you know, if you have, if somebody is going to ask you to figure out where this film is going, you can probably figure it out pretty quickly. But fuck Pixar, they know how to do it.
They sure do.
I cried in this film. I don't cry very often in films, but this one made me tear up. It made me want to hug my brother. He called me yesterday, which is the day after I saw the movie, and I was like, "Hey, you gotta listen, or you gotta watch this movie." And he was like, "Are you sure? It looks kind of bad." And I was like, "No, it's about brothers. I need you to watch it. Tell me what you think when you see it. The heart in this film is so great, and I think if that relationship didn't work, then this film would be failure.
Yes. No, you are absolutely right. Without the success and the success of these two brothers, man, this could be the good dinosaur levels. And that's honestly, I thought I was getting because it kind of looks like the Good Dinosaur, like in that vein of animation. I was like, oh, this is like the good dinosaur. And it's so much better. And I haven't got a chance to check out what it did at the box office yet. I got to kind of work on that.
I think it's a little weak from what I saw recently, that it was around 40 million, which was pretty muted.
And you know what sucks is that people don't understand how much the box office really does drive the impressions that people have on a film, right?
Yeah.
And I feel that this movie deserves more, but we got to understand also what we're combating right now. We talked about it at the front of this podcast. There's something serious going on IRL in real life that are driving people away from being in big open public places and confined spaces. So I think that may have had something to do with it. I don't know.
Yeah. It's really tough to tell how much it has to do with it though, you know, or whether like my brother, maybe people just thought that this wasn't the film that it's trying to be. And you made an interesting point at the beginning where you said it felt like a DreamWorks film, and I didn't make that connection. But you're right. There are, other than like the How to Train Your Dragon series and the very few films that are actually really incredible, a lot of those DreamWorks films have that sort of like we're not Pixar feel to it. You know,
maybe it's like Blue Sky.
Yeah.
You know, like there's something just about this animation style that it's not Coco, it's not Inside Out, it's not Toy Story. So it's like, it's something else. And if the animation style feels like it's in that lower rung of what Pixar's done, and like I said, Pixar has done such exceptional stuff, it feels like something else, you know? So it's really weird, but damn, did I love it. And yeah, so I didn't say my ranking. I have this as my number 12.
Okay. That's, wow, perfect. That is, I believe it's, let me double check. Yeah, it is my number 13.
Okay.
So we are right there.
Look at that.
Yeah. So I think awesome. What that is like almost literally middle of the road.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, and again, you said you ranked it 9 out of 10. This is probably like an 8 out of 10, 8.5 for me. So these are very good films still.
Yeah, I mean, my 1, 2, and 3 are 5-star films or 10 out of 10s for me. Incredibles, Inside Out, and Coco. And then starting with Toy Story 3 all the way down to my number 12 and onward, those are all 9 out of 10 films for me.
Wow, yeah. Let's actually just go ahead and wrap this up, Colby. And why don't you give me your final rankings from worst to best for all 22 of Pixar's films, and then kind of maybe tier them up into kind of categories so that we can kind of really get a feel for the Pixar's quality in their library.
Yeah. So I kind of put this first group of films all in the same rung. Wasn't expecting much. Don't feel like I got much out of it. But there's these 6 films, starting from 22 with The Good Dinosaur and number 21 with Cars 2. Those are legitimately bad movies. They're more bad than they are good. I have those rated at 5 out of 10, those bottom two. But inside the other 4 of my 6 I kind of have grouped together is A Bug's Life at number 20, Cars 3 at number 19, Brave at number 18, and Finding Dory at number 17, which I actually have all of those films at like fine slash okay. So that's kind of where we're at. Then we got this next group of films that I'm going to actually put them all, I all rated them 7 out of 10. So this is number 16, Monsters University, Toy Story 2, number 15, number 14 is Finding Nemo, and I've got number 13 is Incredibles, Finding Nemo is actually a 7 out of 10. I actually have Incredibles 2 as an 8. And the only reason why I gave it an 8, I actually gave it up, is because the one thing that it does do is that if it's going to redo number 1, and amplify everything, give me some great action, and it definitely did that. The Jack short inside the film alone is probably some of the best superhero movie goods of the entire decade. So fair. I'll definitely give it that. And then, like I said, now after this point, that was my number, my last ranked number 8 film, and number 13 went Incredibles 2. From 12, I got Onward, which is a 9 out of 10. These are all 9 out of 10s up until Coco. So 12 is Onward, 11 is Cars, 10 is Monsters, Inc. 9 is Up. WALL-E is 8. Ratatouille is 7. And then pretty much I got back-to-back-to-back Toy Story. 6 Toy Story. 5 Toy Story 4. 4 Toy Story 3. Those were all 9 out of 10 films. And then I got my 10 out of 10. My perfect films. Perfect Pixar movies. Coco at number 3. Inside Out at number 2. And The Incredibles at number 1.
Awesome. And so for me, I would say very similar kind of breakdown, actually. The first couple films I would say are meh to bad, and that would be 22 through 19. That is, 22 is Cars 2, 21. Well, actually, sorry, I should say 22 is a DNS, did not start because I did not watch Cars 2. But 21 is The Incredibles 2, 20 is Brave, and 19 is Finding Dory. Then from, it looks like roughly 18 to 15, I would say those are good-ish films. That's The Good Dinosaur at 18. 17 is Cars 3. 16 is Cars. And 15 is A Bug's Life. And then 14 all the way up to, it looks like 5, I would say are from really good to great. So 15 here is A Bug's Life. Or no, sorry, I already said that. 14 here is Toy Story 2. 13 is Onward, 12 is Coco, 11 is Toy Story 4, 10 is Up, 9 is Toy Story, 8 is Toy Story 3, 7 is WALL-E, 6 is Monsters, Inc., 5 is Monsters University, and these top 4 I would say are absolutely 10 out of 10 films. 4 is The Incredibles, 3 is Ratatouille, 2 is Inside Out, and 1 is Finding Nemo. So, Colby, given these last couple films that we've had and talked about, I think most of them have been pretty positive in the last couple years. How are you feeling about the future of Pixar? And just in general, what are your expectations for a film like Soul, which is coming out later this year?
Does this or does this not have Pete Docter back at the helm?
It does have Peak Doctor. Yeah, who did Inside Out. So
it's gonna knock it out the freaking park. And it's funny because I will say, the first like minute of the trailer, I'm like, I've never, once again, never seen a Pixar movie look like that. Mm-hmm. My only skepticism is then it does this Inside Out thing when my man steps through the manhole and becomes a soul.
Yeah, does he die? Did we just watch a man die in that trailer?
Pretty. So that's, I think. So yeah. But it looks very much like Inside Out. And yeah. Initially I was turned off by it because I'm like, I want the movie. Like, that's the Black Pixar movie that I've been waiting for, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm like, there was this uncanny nature to how beautiful and how beautiful the movie, that trailer sounds, mm-hmm. you know? And then when he takes that step, it turns into a different movie. So I'm interested to see what happens going forward. Because I feel like with Inside Out, maybe I had like a little bit of trepidation because of what came before it. But I'm going to give so much grace to Pete Doctor win me over. I think Pixar obviously is doing some exceptional things, even with their shorts that they just tag along, you know. My daughter watches the Pixar shorts on Disney Plus every week. Mm-hmm. She just watches like all 30 of them or whatever.
Oh, wow.
It's a great company. And I think there's still a lot of stories to be told. And I think that they can get a little bit bolder in the way that they tackle stories. You know, I would love to see Pixar. Maybe it's tough. Maybe Pixar can't not do a kids movie. I would love to see what they do for like a teen film, you know, or something like that. It'd be very interesting. But like, I trust, and I think Disney knows what... They know not to meddle so much. I feel like in the latter years, they were meddling a little bit. You know, like, I mean, didn't Disney do... Disney did Planes, right? That was Disney's. Yeah. So, like, they're like, oh, we could do this Cars thing, too. No, you can't. You know, so... I'm excited for it. And I think that Disney's learned from it. You know, I mean, there's some films you're like, oh, is that a Pixar film? Sometimes it's hard to kind of distinguish between the two. Like, man, Wreck-It Ralph seems like a Pixar movie. No, it's not a Pixar movie. Oh, really? Yeah. It's not. Oh, Big Hero 6. Oh, it's not a Pixar movie. But, like... Yeah, I'm excited for what's coming. You know, I don't know if they should keep doing the whole 2 a year thing now. That's something that's kind of happened more recently. Mm-hmm. But if as long as they're great, I got no problem with it.
Yeah, I'm very optimistic about Soul and then just in general Pixar's future. So I hope that they will focus more on original properties, especially with everything that Disney's doing nowadays. I think Pixar is a great well for original storytelling. So I really hope that they allow Pixar to do that and just stay out of their way, because Pixar clearly knows what it's doing. And for every kind of miss, there are two or three just beautiful and powerful films. All right, so this has been our Pixar Marathon Review episode. I am recording this outro a couple days later because Colby's audio got a little bit messed up and I couldn't quite figure out a way how to smooth it out. But as always, it was an absolute blast to have Colby on the podcast. It always feels like just a casual conversation whenever Colby is on, and I'm really looking forward to continuing to collaborate with him in the future. Colby has a lot of projects going on right now that you definitely should all check out. He just recently started the Black Label podcast as a part of the Feelin' Film podcast family, where four critics of color sit down to discuss their love for movies. He is also a part of the Minorities Report podcast and hosts his own podcast, the Colby Told Me podcast. This man is just a podcasting machine, so it always means a lot when he takes the time to sit down and talk to me. I will provide all the links to these podcasts in the show notes, but you should also follow Colby on Twitter at ColbyToldMe. He's genuinely one of the nicest and best people to follow on that site. So thank you again, Colby, for joining me on today's episode. The intro music for this episode is a piece called Work by Kevin MacLeod, and you can find more of his work at incompetech.com. If you'd like to keep up with this podcast and find out when we release new episodes, you can follow us on Twitter at MovieMaraPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/MovieMaraPod. That's Movie MARAPod. And you can always reach out to us at our email, MovieMarathonersPod@gmail.com. You can find more episodes of this podcast on Podbean at MovieMarathoners.podbean.com. And we are also on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, and Spotify. If you are on iTunes, please subscribe there or write a review if you like what we're doing. Really, any feedback you have to help improve the podcast is always appreciated. Thank you all for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time when I am joined by my marathon buddies Ian Anderson and Johnny Klimps for a Nikki Caro double feature. She is directing the upcoming live-action remake of Mulan, but before she did that, she made her directorial debut with a film called Whale Rider, and then went on to direct McFarlane USA, which is possibly one of, and one of the only, but one of the best films about running. So I think that should be a really fun conversation that we'll have as we kind of prepare for the Boston Marathon coming in April. Assuming no coronavirus delay, please, please, please. But stay tuned for that. Until then, bye.
My name is Cindy Burnett, and each week I interview at least two traditionally published authors on my podcast, Thoughts from a Page. We talk spoiler-free about their books, so you can listen whether you have read the book or not. And then we delve into things that you most likely won't hear about anywhere else. The importance of the cover design, why they included various aspects of the story, personal details about both the books and the authors' lives, and so much more. You can find the podcast on every major platform and learn more about it on my website, thoughtsfromapage.com. Thanks so much for checking it out.